happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, we've got John Rauhouse playing in the background. Today on the podcast, I thought we should revisit a story that was close to my heart. It ran in the Fretboard Journal, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. All the years seem to blend in right now, as do all the days. The story is that of the Daridin Guitar Company. This was a luthier, David Murray, who, with his family, moved from the States to the foothills of the Himalayas in India and decided to start a guitar company, not only to build amazing guitars, but also to teach some of the locals who desperately could use income and a craft how to build instruments on a very high level. This story immediately appealed to me. The minute I heard about it, I wanted to get David in the magazine. We also got him at our Fretboard Summit talking about this project, and I wanted to revisit this because David recently announced that the guitar company is no longer, and I wanted to just hear what happened, how it unfolded, what he is up to next, because he and his globetrotting family are definitely not done with the world of guitars or helping out others. They are amazing people, and I'm glad to call them friends, and so I wanted to get him on the podcast. So all the way from another side of the world, here we have on the podcast, David Murray. This was recorded about a month ago, but still in the midst of the pandemic that we're all in, of course. And I hope you enjoy this conversation. Closer to home here in Seattle, Washington, we are now sending out the second Electric Guitar Annual. This is our kind of standalone project, a book of sorts, entirely about the world of electric guitars. Most folks know us as a primarily acoustic-leaning publication. I always love a challenge. So it was really our opportunity to kind of tap into that universe in the tasteful and unique and perhaps esoteric way that we tap into everything here at the Fretboard Journal. Folks who pre-ordered it should be seeing it within about a week. If you have not pre-ordered it, you can still either buy a download PDF edition or the keepsake print edition, and we will get that mailed to you within a few days. Beyond all that, we're working on Fretboard Journal 46, which looks to be another amazing issue. That'll be mailing in about a month. We have a bunch of podcasts you should check out if you haven't yet. The last podcast before this one, where I talked to luthiers Jason Kostel and Todd Luneberg about the guitars they built using wood from President Carter's wood grove, is amazing. Check that out if you haven't yet. We also have Luthier on Luthier, a whole podcast dedicated to the world of guitar making, hosted by luthier Michael Bashkin. And then last but not least, we have the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, which I co-host. I'm sort of the Ed McMahon of that operation. Skip Simmons, a Northern California amp tech for decades, is the host, and he fields all your questions. It's kind of like car talk. It's pretty informative and it's pretty hilarious. And I think you will like it, even if you don't really care about tube amps. Check it out. We do, as always, have a couple of sponsors. First up, our friends over at Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire line of gig bags and laptop bags and studio monitor stands and pedal boards. Everything they do has such a great attention to detail and is so well thought out. And they have such a wide array of products. I mean, they have gig bags for DJs as well as gig bags for classical guitars. I love my Mono Vertigo case for my Telecaster. I have used it all the time and still do as I move stuff around from my house to my garage and to the office and stuff. Check out everything they're up to. And if you're not in the market for gig bags right now because you're not touring or playing music, check out their studio monitor stands and some of the other stuff they have. I think you will like all their products. monocreators.com, again, is where you can read up on everything that they are up to. And our other podcast sponsor, once again, is our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. Retrofret continues to get some of the coolest guitars I have ever seen, even during a pandemic. I don't know how they do it. But once again, our friends at Retrofret have a Burns. They keep getting these amazing Burns Baldwin guitars. They've got the Baby Bison right now from 1965, solid body guitar, $950. That seems like an amazing deal for a rare, weird, goofy guitar that will be the talk of the town. Also on the budget end of the spectrum, they have a 1965 Silvertone Model 1444 electric bass guitar. Another great under $1,000 deals. And then moving up the spectrum a little bit, they have a 67 Fender Princeton Reverb tube amp, which is basically all the amp you will ever need for the rest of your life, unless you are playing big shows. And even if you are, you just mic it. One of the great amplifiers of all time. Check that out. And everything that they do over at retrofret.com. They also do incredible restoration and repair work. I've recommended them to so many people, not only on the East Coast, but also around the country if they're looking for any guitar repair stuff. Again, thank you, Retrofret. If you do reach out to them, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. All right, that's all I have for you today. Again, thank you for your support of this podcast. Thank you for tuning in during these crazy times. This is my conversation with David Murray of the Darendin Guitar Company. Keep the feedback coming. Keep the emails coming. If there's anyone you want to see on this podcast next, let us know. We talked about you. We featured you in the magazine, what, 5-6 years ago. And, you know, you and your family are amazing. You travel the world. You did this amazing thing setting up this guitar factory and teaching these people. And then I thought things were plugging along, but at some point you got thrown out of the country.
Yeah. We, under this new sort of Hindu nationalist agenda of Prime Minister Modi's government, some of the, you know, administrators in that government were trying to throw out anybody that wasn't Hindu. And I guess we sort of fell into that net, more or less. And there were also a lot of people that were on business visas in India that were just sort of kicking around and living there and doing whatever they wanted. We're not really doing business. And so maybe that's the net we fell into. But at any rate, yeah, we got asked not to come back when we were on our way out of immigration in 2015, June. And so since then, we've just been trying to figure out how to keep everything going that we had established. By that point, I think we had something around, now the guitar company had around 12 guys building at that time. Then we had a handbag company that had around 250 artisans. And so it's just been a slog just trying to figure out how to keep all that going. And it's been really difficult for sure.
And so you was the initial, obviously this came probably as a shock to you, was the initial impulse like we can kind of manage this remotely, or was it to give the keys to the factory workers, or what was your strategy?
I don't know. The strategy was something along the lines of survive any way that you can. And so what happened with the guitar company is I had had a couple of guys training with me on final setup. And they didn't quite feel confident enough to do those final touches at the time. And over the ensuing couple of years, they got better and better at it. But, they would send me guitars in the white, and I would do the finish work in the US for the most part. And then I would do the final setup there as well and send them on to the customers. And that worked. I had to set up almost an entire shop just to do that. I mean, just setting up a spray booth is a bear, as anybody out there knows. So it wasn't easy. But we just tried to survive until the guys could take all the processes. And we were in the U.S. in Kansas City and then in Arkansas for a while. And then we decided, you know what, we're going to move back to Asia to be closer to the work. But concurrent with that move, the guys really had to take the reins. Because I was moving yet again to a place where I had no shop to support them. And so that was really the moment, about 18 months after we got kicked out, that the guys took the reins start to finish. and started delivering guitars directly to customers. And that was really kind of a triumph in a way, you know. But we had to almost manufacture a situation that would have that required that, that forced our hand and made us kind of grow up and figure it out. And, you know, the other thing that was happening at that same time, I think we got kicked out June 2015. And by January, was it? Or was it 17? When CITES kicked in. Mm-hmm. And then we couldn't ship any more guitars to the U.S., which was our biggest market at the time. And so we had to completely pivot and start delivering India, which was a market we had always planned on developing, but we were forced to develop it overnight. And so, yeah, we had all kinds of hits coming, and we just tried to survive, you know, and the guys really did everything that they could and did a great job and survived for several years. So, but now we're at the point where I just was able to finally get back in the country after 4 years, and 4 years of a lawsuit, 16 hearings in the high court. And we finally won and got a letter from the Minimum Affairs that no further impediment. Basically, we're sorry we were wrong. And, you know, went back to visit and just to sort of reassess with the guys and decide, where are we at, guys, you know, and so that's where maybe this story begins.
Yeah. Well, where were they at?
Well, we, you know, look, we had built guitars together because we loved building guitars. We loved music. We loved strumming together and we loved being together. We had never really built a guitar company. You know, this was a ragtag, a group of young men who were just enjoying life together. And that's how the guitar company began. We call it a company. But each guitar that we built was custom, one-off, unique. And that's not a good way to build a system, to build a foundation under a sustaining business. And so I think that what we realized when we sat together in September is if this thing is truly going to be a healthy business someday, we have to rebuild starting with the foundation and so I guess that's it's sort of a restart, and it's a decision at that point. Do we take all of the learning and the resources that we built up over these years and go, yeah, we're willing to completely press a reset button and work with these resources that we've developed over the years, but really retool everything? Or has it just been hard enough and expensive enough and heartbreaking enough that we need to just hang it up for a while? And I think what we decided is that over the coming year or so, if we're going to ever have a healthy business, that we need to build a healthy business on paper. And then we need to make sure that we go out and get all the investment that we need in order to have a healthy business in reality. But that's just going to take a lot of work to get there, man. Anybody you talk to in the guitar industry will tell you this is not a great way to make money. It's always hard. I was even talking with Bob Taylor, who's been one of my mentors for the last few years. I actually met him at the Fretboard Summit.
Sure.
Down, what was it, near San Diego, right?
Rancho. Sure. Bernardo.
What's
yeah.
it called? Bernardo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first time I met him and showed him one of our guitars. And he goes, oh my goodness, this is, you know, this is amazing, but I understand how challenging it must be too. And I said, man, I mean, well, you guys don't have the challenge of building, right? You just got to sell a lot of guitars. He goes, no, you'd be surprised. Building is always the most difficult part. And that really kind of, it did surprise me coming from Taylor. You would think, oh, well, if anybody's got it dialed in, they've got it dialed in. But he said, no, it's just a constant. It's always a constant challenge to figure out how to build these things. And so I kind of feel like we're back at square one, Jason.
Okay. I mean, I have so many questions. I mean, this had to have been I mean, you're not making any money off of this at all. I mean, hearing you having to do setup work in America, just the postage alone, the shipping must have been a killer.
No. Yeah. Yeah, no, it was always a labor of love, and it was always expensive for me. And luckily, I had a group of friends who came around me and goes, man, you know, said, hey, we'll help out with this too. We'll pay for the, actually, ABF Freight sent us a container at their cost. Because they liked what we were doing. And we had half a dozen people over the years who just said, hey, what do you need right now? Okay, you need a new table saw? Let me hook you up with that. And, you know, I was just one of those people. I was not the only one who was giving to this. There were a handful of people who were making it happen. I was just giving my time. But that was a pleasure, you know. And it was always a pleasure as long as we were together. It just made it so worth it. What we were doing seemed worth doing. And the friendships that we were building around it were, you know, they were worth the price of admission. And we always knew, we felt, you know, at some point, this is going to really start working financially too. And I think that it, had we not gotten kicked out, you know, that was absolutely the direction that we were going. But, yeah, no, I always paid to play, and that's okay. It's been worth it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and it was just hearing you mention earlier that, you know, it was impossible to get guitars into the U.S. I'm so used to hearing people in the U.S. talk about like, well, I can't sell this to Canada. I can't sell this to Europe. But it was kind of eye opening just hearing that, of like, oh, these are guitars made in India that you can't get into the States.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what happened. But when CITES hit, the Indian government also decided, hey, let's also have our own department to specialize in this. And so not only did you have to figure out how to jump through all the CITES hoops, you had to get, you know, specially qualified by the Indian government itself to export. And that was a whole new regulation that they rolled out at the same time. And so it was, well, you can ask the guys at Overseas Traders, Ankit Yogi and his dad Sanjay, like, they were not able to export Rosewood, I think, for nearly a year. I mean, it nearly tanked their business. They've been, they've been cutting for Martin for four generations, and in one moment, and cutting sustainably, I believe. And so, in one moment, everything changed for all of us over there too. Yeah.
Wow. So what was the final tally? How many guitars were you able to make?
I, you know, it was kind of funny, Jason, when there were three or four of us building together, we'd finish about one a week. And then when there were like eight of us, we'd finish about one a week. And then we had 12 builders building one a week. I think we kind of figured out, oh, our facility is our worst employee. It's like, you know, the power's out 3 hours a day. And it was impossible to control humidity, but we fought it every step of the way. But that's what we did. Basically, on average, we did one a week for several years. And after we really got going, after the first few years. So I think we probably tallied up somewhere around 200, 250 guitars or something like that.
Okay.
Not very many Derridoons out there in the wild. I've got one left that's for sale. So we had nine that were completed and unsold at the time that we suspended operations there. And I think we're down to the last one. So.
Wow.
Yep.
I mean, it's you mentioned something else that we didn't even touch upon in this interview, which is, in addition to the political climate and the economics of running operation like this in India, the actual climate is awful, right, for making guitars.
Yeah, you know, I think that that should have been one of my first considerations. You know, we're thinking about building a guitar company for India in India. Where do we do that? Rajasthan would probably be the only correct answer. Everywhere else is a terrible idea. But, you know, and not only because the monsoon season is so wet, but because the construction methods there are not tight. And, you know, the walls hold water, you know, it's just a concrete block and deteriorating paints. And, so it's really difficult to insulate something. And then even if you can get it insulated, you're not going to have sufficient power to actually keep it dry, because the power is going to be out several hours a day, especially in the worst seasons. You know, when it's raining, the power goes out. So, I think that if we could start over, we would start with a fully insulated, purpose-built facility, and we would do it maybe in Rajasthan rather than the foothills of the Himalayas where the monsoons just dump, you know. But you know, we were able to do what we needed to do. We would take a small room and just wall it off and paint everything with waterproof paints and hang plastic sheeting and put two, you know, dehumidifiers and an air conditioner in there. That's where we would assemble. We did whatever it took to keep delivering guitars, you know. But it did feel just like a ridiculous fight sometimes.
I can't
sure
imagine. So did any of these guys that worked there for so long and eventually were able to do finished work themselves, are any of them going to carry the torch and keep building instruments, or you don't know?
Yeah, well, one of them is doing repairs right in the old shop. And he does a wonderful job. His name is TP, and he has a little repair shop called Dune Guitar Repairs. And he's one of two repair specialists in the country that I know of. The other guy's in Mumbai, and, you know, TP worked beside me on the bench for 5 years. And then he was our lead, quality and setup guy and repair guy for the following 5 years. So he's got that going. And I really hope that's successful for him and his family. Three of the other guys have started a little furniture, custom furniture business. I think they decided, man, okay, look, we've learned a ton building guitars, but they are a pain. Let's build something that's a little easier and funner. So they're building like beds and end tables. And of course, they're like the best in town, because those guys understand quality now like nobody else. And so, yeah, I'm happy to see that some of them are still doing woodworking, and they're making their own way. You know, they've kind of grown up now. They came to me when they were in their late teens, and now they're having, you know, families and wives and their own homes. And so they're making stuff happen. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they do in the future. I'd love to see some of them choose to build guitars. We've sent two down to Bangalore to work with the a friend of ours, Lucas Bruner, who's got an effort that he started down there a few years ago. And he's a wonderful builder, and I think he'll be a wonderful source of, you know, continued training for those guys. So, yeah, we'll see what comes of it. I think what we were able to do in India was sort of ignite this excitement about building instruments that had been there since the first visit from the Beatles back in the late 60s. A guy named Ajit Singh had started building in Dehradun and built consistently there till 1985. And he's a good friend of mine, still runs a music store in downtown Dehradun. But it had kind of lain dormant for a while. And then a guy named Arisa Neoji, who had worked with Richard Hoover at Santa Cruz, came back to India in the 1980s, and he was the only builder down in South India for a while, and a guy named Arul Dominic Xavier. So there were basically two luthiers in the country when I got there, as far as I know. But we were the first ones to try to make a go of it as a manufacturer, you know. And so I think that since we started doing that, I don't know, we're not going to take credit for it, but it's been fun to see other independent luthiers spring up in the ensuing years. And I think there's probably a dozen of them now. And so that's been kind of cool to see.
Yeah. Now you are.
Did I change the subject there?
Yeah. Well,
I didn't mean to.
No. So you are currently in Thailand. What are you guys doing there?
Well, you know, I can't help it, but to have a shop here. So I have a little workshop. I'm completing work on a couple instruments that were in process in the shop that I brought back here just recently, last month. And my wife runs a business accelerator for local entrepreneurs who are trying to start their own businesses. And she's got 14 entrepreneurs, I think, right now that she's working with. And she runs a think runs, but she has a hub of business resources, which are just people in people who can do legal work, people who can do design, people who do specialty business training and consulting. And so she basically kind of hooks these entrepreneurs up with all kinds of resources to help them get on their feet, help them make good decisions early on. And then is able to put them in front of, we call them impact investors, investors who are willing to risk money to help people in the developing world make their dreams come true. So that's kind of the process that she runs right now. And right now I'm in my shop building guitar jigs because I can't help it. I just keep doing it.
Yeah. Does Thailand, after a tumultuous several years in India, does Thailand feel like a permanent home, or you're not sure?
Oh man, that's a really timely question, Jason. I mean, I came over here to help, to continue to contribute to growing the guitar company. You know, Mel found her feet here with running this business accelerator, but we're definitely casting an eye back to the U.S. these days with all these concerns about the virus and just sort of feeling like you want to be close to family. You kind of feel pretty far flung out here sometimes. I mean, I'm looking out my patio doors here at the jungle, you know. I mean, we've got some pineapple fields here, and then it just melts into bamboo forests, and Myanmar is right on the other side of its mouth, and you just sort of feel like, I don't know, kids miss the grandparents and things like that. And we might like to be a little closer to family for the coming season. So yeah, we're starting to think through that.
So right around the time you dial in this workshop, you'll have to pack it all up.
Well, if that's what happens, luckily, I've got a really wonderful local guy here who's running it on a daily basis, and he's trying to build something that he could sort of invite his village into. So he's coming up with different products, mostly using bamboo, which is a wonderful material because it's just like grass over here. It's everywhere. And so he's making lamps, and he's making vases to hold flowers, and he's making cups, like coffee cups. He's just doing a lot of really cool stuff with bamboo, and I've got no regrets if he ends up continuing to run that shop after I leave. I'll be happy that we built it together. So
yeah, I know at least a few ukuleles have been made of bamboo or a bamboo laminate. I don't know of any guitars, but you probably would.
Yeah, I do. There is one company that has made some kind of laminate that they seem pretty excited about, and I think I saw them at NAMM a few years ago. So hopefully they've had some success with it. To process bamboo is pretty intense. Can be done, but we would have to drop a lot of infrastructure on the ground to make sheet goods out of bamboo.
Got it.
You know, it's quite thin walled, and you have to slice it. You have to slice it up quite a bit to get it to where you can relaminate it. So we haven't gone that direction.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So having gone, I mean, I know it's probably too early to say, but having been through this whole process, starting out as an independent luthier, you know, basically being philanthropic, helping these people out in a developing country, can you go back to just being a solo guitar maker, or is this always going to be in you now that you want to bring other people into the fold and teach them the craft?
Well, it's interesting. I got a call 2 days ago from some businessmen in Mumbai that want to buy the brand and the equipment and be a part of the next chapter of Dehradun Guitar Company. I may stay involved with them in some respect there. They kind of feel like they would need my guidance. And so if that's the direction it goes, that's fine. That would be great. I think it needs to exist. I think I'll never not be able to build instruments. I love woodworking, but being able to string something up and for it to be help you make music afterwards is sort of the best version of woodworking for me. I think maybe something akin to that might be building a boat and sailing it, you know? So who knows, maybe that's the direction we'll go next. But I think I'll always build instruments, Jason. I'm not sure under what name, but it looks like in the coming season I'll be operating out of Kansas City. And I've got a shop there, and I'd like to get it dialed in. And yeah, I'll probably keep building guitar jigs, you know. So, but you know, this it may be the end, you know, for the Arizona Guitar Company. If that's so, it's been a great run. And you mentioned it being sort of a philanthropic endeavor, but for me, it was a dream come true, man. I mean, it couldn't have been any more exactly what I was hoping to do. So in a way, it was kind of a selfish endeavor. It was absolutely right down the middle for me. I think that if we hadn't gotten blacklisted from India, then I think we'd be building a guitar a day by now, you know, and we'd just, I don't think we would have missed a beat. But this whole thing has been really difficult for me, man, because this was like a dream that I think I started having when I was a teenager. Like, okay, I want to make a difference somewhere, but I also really love the guitar. And so everything kind of came together for 5 years there. And I'm grateful for that, because I don't think everybody gets to live their dream, you know, and I got to do that for 5 years, and I'm just super grateful for that, and grateful for the friendships that were built along the way, and for the guys who came alongside me and worked so hard. And man, they really tried, you know, they really tried hard. I think if we could do it all again, maybe I would do it a little differently, but I sure would do it, even with the pain, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know it hasn't been easy, but as a parent, your family and your kids have gone on the world's greatest adventure, and it sounds like you continue to do that. Like, you've done well.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, I have so much to be thankful for, and it's cool that we have kids who, they're flexible. But we bring them into the conversation. If we're talking about Kansas City, Mel and I don't sit and make plans together. We get the boys, they're now 13 and 14, and we sit around this big table that I built. It's like a dining lounge. We just sort of like, it's so comfortable that we just sort of lay back after a meal and just keep talking or play a family game or whatever. We just sit there and talk. Hey guys, what do we want to do next? And here's what we're thinking. Here's how it's gone. How's school? And are you missing the grandparents? What do you guys want to do? And so what's been cool about it is that we are the one thing that has been a lot of different places. Mel and I have been married 20 years, and we've lived in 22 houses. And and the boys have been along for a lot of that ride. But they're part of the conversation. And so, yeah, it's been good. And it doesn't hurt that they get along. Like, they're good buddies. They're 14 months apart. And so we've just got a built-in buddy system, you know, makes it pretty easy.
Yeah. That's incredible. Not to go back to silly stuff, but tell us about this last guitar you have. What is it like?
Well, the first guitars that we made in the shop were inspired by the Martin 00, which is that 12 frets to the body. And just, I don't know, I've had one since 1999. I bought one used, an 85. And I know that's not like a highly pedigreed, you know, era of Martin guitars, but like, been all over the world with me. It went with me to Uganda when we worked in an orphanage there. It obviously went to India with me. It's been to Central and South America with me. And they're this small and portable, and you can sort of wrap yourself around them, and they're great in the living room. So that's what we built early on. And that's the last one that we built as well. It was it's a double O, but it's sort of our take on it. It has Claro walnut, like figured Claro walnut, back and sides that I got from a friend who built the executive conference table for Facebook out of this stuff and gave me the cutoff. And yeah, not that that matters. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And then it's got a Western Red Cedar soundboard and abalone border from Advanced Shell Technologies. That stuff that Kevin Ryan makes. It's Kevin Barb. That's so beautiful, and it's really good looking little guitar. Satin body and a gloss top, and you know, it just sounds the way it should. So that's the last one. We did these offset sound hole guitars as well, which is something we started doing in the last few years. And so we had a few of those left at the end that we had just completed, and those all sold too. So,
wow, end of an era.
Yeah, yeah, it is. But you know, I was reading this book that Bob Taylor wrote called Guitar Stories. It's a really good book.
Yeah.
And any luthiers, especially who haven't read it, have got to read it. It's just, I mean, everything feels familiar except that he's so stinking productive from very early on. But even then, he had to, the guy is a, you know, he's a force. He's a freak of nature. He's got absolutely that right blend of artistry and engineering and management skills to have pulled off what he did. You had to be him. But this book is pretty cool. And one thing he describes is that he kind of had to reset Taylor guitars twice. And he talks about this valley, Spring Valley, which is just adjacent to El Cajon, where Taylor Guitars is located. And he talks about how it took a couple generations of settlers coming in, building up resources, and eventually giving up before the third generation was able to finally come into Spring Valley. And, you know, there were roads, there were houses, there were fences, there were tilled fields. There'd just been, maybe there had been a drought for a couple of years and the last generation had given up. But this third generation came in with new energy, and there were all of these existing resources for them to take advantage of, wells, irrigation, et cetera. And all they had to do was improve on that. And he kind of looked at that and decided, I'm going to be the third owner of Taylor Guitars. I'm not going to give up. And I feel like I'm at the point right now. I do think there will be another chapter for Derridin Guitar Company. I just don't know if I'm going to be the third, that third owner or not. I think that this needs to be owned by Indians. I think that that is sort of the ultimate version of Derridin Guitar Company, is it is owned and run by a group of passionate, talented Indians who can reach their own market and build this into something that a foreigner like myself really wasn't designed to do. They understand the culture. They understand the challenges. And well, they don't have to get a visa either.
Yeah.
It's harder for them to get kicked out. So I'm hoping maybe that that's the ultimate expression of this. And if that happens and these builders that I worked with for so long are able to be offered a place there, that would just be like, well, that would really be coming full circle. That would give me a lot of joy.
Yeah.
So.
Well, man, you like Bob.
So that seems to be what may be in the... I do.
No, I was going to say, you are like Bob. You are a force of nature, whether you realize it or not. And it's really inspiring to hear what you're saying. And I can't wait to see what happens both to those guys as well as to you.
Yeah, well, Jason, you've been keeping something going for a long time, too. And what is the immediate situation due to Fretboard Journal, and how can the greater community here go, I don't know, be aware of the challenges that you're facing right now?
Well, I mean, I think we've, you know, we've always been pretty clear that the easiest way to support the magazine is through subscribing to us. And, you know, I think that had we started 10 years earlier when magazines were maybe more of a focal point in people's lives, it would have been a lot easier. But, you know, we've always had enough people to keep us going, and we've always wanted a few more to help us do the next great thing. But yeah, I mean, we wouldn't be in business today if we had a different business model that was more advertising based, because the advertising has gotten, you know, to use a common business phrase, softer and softer over the years. And I don't think that with the virus, it's gonna, I mean, obviously a lot of, I'm afraid to say it, but I think a lot of guitar stores and perhaps some guitar companies that they would be advertisers or dealers for something like this are going to go under. And that's awful. You know, I mean, we're already seeing it with musicians struggling already just from having to cancel tours and venues. I don't know how venues are going to be able to survive. It's not like anyone running a rock or folk club was doing it for the money to begin with. So, I don't know. I think the only thing I will tell people is just, if you actually love something and you love what they're doing, like, just support them. Like, it doesn't, whether or not it's the Fretboard Journal, whatever it is, I think sometimes we all take stuff for granted. We're busy paying our monthly Netflix bill or, you know, whatever. And we sometimes forget that these little indie companies could desperately use our help. So, I mean, that's my plea for the Fretboard Journal is, if you've liked what we've done, and I say this every week, but, you know, please support us. And now, you know, versus 15 years ago, we're a lot more than just a magazine. We do these podcasts, which reach people on a weekly basis, and we do videos, and we were doing events. We were going to do another summit until this coronavirus hit. And so we had to cancel that for this year. So I don't know. It's all crazy.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a great venue.
Yeah.
We're still going to do it in 2021 if we're all still here and want to do it. But the Chicago's Old Town School, which is just a literal institution. It's an, you know, they have tens of thousands of music students every week, and facilities with, you know, concert halls and classrooms and everything. It's like a turnkey venue for an event like this. And so I was really glad when they called us up out of the blue and offered to let us put the summit on there. And then one thing led to another, and here we are, pandemic time. So we're just all self-preservation.
Well, yeah. Well, whenever it is rescheduled, I definitely want to hear about it, which reminds me, I need to renew my subscription, make sure my subscription is current.
I think you need to,
I let it lapse for a few months there.
I think you need to, settle down somewhere first.
Yeah. Should I have an address for you?
I think you should have an address. Maybe find one that's, yeah, local, domestic at least. Who knows? So
we'll make it. We'll make it through.
And oh, we will.
That's the nice thing about having a business that where you didn't scale it massively. You know, it's not like you've got 200 employees that you've got to,
yeah,
that you've got to support right now. And there's a lot to be said, man, for just hunkering down. You'll be all right.
Oh, we'll be fine.
And I'm really glad you're out there doing something beautiful. You know, I think beauty is always going to be in favor. So,
yeah, I mean, it's sort of like what you were saying about Bob and you, and I think this applies to a lot of people. Is, you know, I didn't, 15 years ago when I started this thing, it was because I wanted to create a beautiful guitar magazine. I've come to realize countless times over that period that, you know, it wasn't about the magazine at all. It was about turning people on to interesting people and interesting instruments and storytelling. And so podcasts, the digital version of the magazine that we now send to people all around the world that, you know, just gets delivered to your inbox, like, that's still the same goal, right? It's still scratching that itch. It may not be a beautiful, you know, thing that you put on your coffee table, but it's all about turning people onto good stuff, which is really what excites me more than anything. It's not, you know, printing a book that takes 3 weeks to produce and, you know, trees are cut down. that's fun and it's beautiful, but it's the storytelling is really all that matters. And there's a lot of different ways to do that now. So I'm confident we'll figure something out.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of interesting people in this industry.
Yeah. You are
one of them. Who are living interesting lives and who are engaged in their communities. And well, it's fun to be a part of this community. And I would say that's one of the biggest things. When you ask me if I'm going to, you know, hang a shingle in Kansas City, yeah, probably, because I really like the people who are around guitars and music, and I want to be around them, you know?
Sure.
And so I'm just going to keep doing that somehow or another.
So, I love it. Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me all the way from Thailand. This is the most far-flung interview I think I've done.
Yeah, absolutely. Good deal. Well, yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. It doesn't get much further away from Seattle than Chiang Rai, Thailand.
All right.
You'd be hard-pressed to find an interview further away. Yeah.